This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in studio with my producer, Lee Delapina. And yes, this is the show trainers listen to, and each and every week, I have the opportunity to visit with so many of the people that make our sport a success. And you know I'm talking about those dedicated individuals who get up every morning. They're at the barn at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock every morning, 365 days of year, 7 days a week. There are no holidays when you're training racehorses, and our two guests tonight know that better than anybody. Randy Morse will be with me in the first half of the program, and Bobby Barnett in the second half as we kick off another brand new edition of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on HRRN. As I mentioned, Randy Morse, our first guest this evening, the 52-year-old Texas native, has just surpassed the 800 win mark. His total stands at 801. Those runners have earned more than $18 million in purses. And again, he's with me here tonight on Trainer Talk. Randy, thanks so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And pretty impressive, man. $18 million in earnings. Where'd all that money go?
I don't know.
It's funny because I'll ask a lot of trainers what goes through their mind when they hear those kind of numbers, and those are very impressive. And they'll say, geez, I wonder where all that money went. That's the first thing they think of.
Yeah, but as everyone knows, we have a lot of bills, a lot of expenses. So.
Yeah, it certainly does. Well, take me back to the beginning with Randy Morse. You're growing up in Texas. Your dad was a trainer for a long time. Take me back to the beginning. Tell me how you got hooked on racing.
I mean, I was literally born on the racetrack. My granddad was a trainer, and then, you know, my mom and dad both worked at the racetrack. And I have two brothers and a sister. And my sister is actually my assistant trainer now. She's with some horses in Iowa. And, I mean, that's just the way we did it then. You know, there are a lot of people, their families, you know, we didn't have outside help. We just all pitched in and done it together.
You said you were literally born on the racetrack. You were born on the racetrack?
Well, I mean, I've been on the racetrack since I was knee high. I was walking horses off a pony when I was like 6 years old. So.
Wow. Well, tell me about growing up around the barn, because it's different than so many other trainers that we talked to where, you know, maybe they were doing other things and then at some point decided to be a trainer. But I guess you always had this in your blood. You always knew that you wanted to be involved in the sport?
Yeah, when I was younger, you know, I wanted to be a jockey. I was always real small. I was getting on horses, you know, every chance I could gallop the pony or to get on a horse of any kind, I wanted opportunity. And then when I turned 15, I all of a sudden grew too much to the jockey deal was out of the question. So, but from that point on, yeah, I didn't want to go to college. And I got my trainer's license when I was 18. When I first turned 18.
Wow. You know, I've talked to so many trainers on this program over the past couple of years, and I can't tell you, Randy, how many times I hear that story where people want to grow up and be a jockey first, and then they get too big and they end up training horses. It's amazing the way you hear that throughout so many trainers' careers.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Yeah, I galloped horses for a long, long time, and then I haven't in the last several years. I got too big to even do that, so.
Wow. So your dad, tell me about your dad and his career.
I mean, I think my dad was an excellent horseman. He just, you know, he never was given the opportunity to train, you know, the better horses, but he did well with what he had. I mean, he was pretty well respected, I think, anybody that knew him. He raced around Sunland Park, and we would go to Exarban in the summers. and the old Centennial out in Denver, Colorado. Kind of that was a circuit.
Wow, that's going back a ways too.
Yeah.
What are some of the lessons that your dad taught you, some of the things he instilled in you that you still remember to this day?
Well, he always, you know, take care of the horse. I mean, you know, there's no reason for a horse not to look good. And, you know, basic things, check their legs. And, you know, there's a lot of things that these new breed of trainers, I don't think they've been taught how to do a lot of the old-timey ways. Not that it makes any difference, I guess, but...
Yeah, well, isn't there a difference? There's a difference between a trainer and a horseman, isn't there?
Well, yeah. The old-timey guys will tell you that. Yeah, you know, like myself, I still run most of my vet wrap and stuff when I race a horse. You know, I don't wait over on the front side for him to come to the paddock. Things like that.
Yeah. How would you sum up your philosophy when it comes to training horses, Randy?
You just need a fast horse.
Yeah.
All that other stuff, you know, bottom line is you need, first of all, you need good owners that put a good horse in your barn. Without that, don't matter what you do, you know, you can't do it without the horse.
Now, you've had some good owners over the years. Tell me about some of those owners and the people that have supported you.
Yeah, my first big break was a man named Mr. Robert Mitchell. He was from Tulsa. And he was the first one to really give me a chance. You know, we claimed a lot of horses. Most of the stake horses that I've had have been horses that I've claimed. We claimed a filly named Prospector Song, her first start for $50,000. She was a real nice filly, and several others. But he was, you know, first guy that really gave me my best opportunity.
Was that your first big break?
Yes. Yes.
So when you're claiming horses like that, that's a different game than playing, say, at the grade one level necessarily. Talk to me, and of course you've been at that high level too. We're going to talk about some of those big horses that you had, but when you're claiming horses, is there a certain thing that you're looking for, Randy, or something in particular that you have a game plan in mind when you're looking at a certain horse?
You know, usually you want somewhere horse with conditions. Somewhere, you know, that you think they can take that next step up and improve. I like claiming young horses, maidens, you know. A lot of times you can catch somebody trying to take a little advantage running the horse, you know, a little cheaper than maybe they're worth. And, you know, they might turn into something. I mean, we don't never know till we run them, you know, no matter how they train in the mornings. A lot of them work fast and run slow in the mornings. So, and some of them work slow in the mornings and then they run good in the afternoon. So, I like a real good looking horse. I don't like ugly horses. Not that makes them run, but.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you there. We're talking about Randy Morse here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Randy, what would you consider to be your greatest claim?
I claimed a horse called Morlock years ago at Gulfstream for $50,000, and he run out, I think, $1.2 million. He was awful good horse.
Did you know when you were claiming him that did you have those bigger races in mind, or did you just think, hey, we'll just try to move him up?
No, you just always hope for the best. No, anybody tells you that, that's no. You know, I've claimed a lot of bad ones too.
Yeah, I'm sure. It seems like that's the mantra with so many guys that do that do claim at that level. How about, let's go back to your family here for just a minute. You said your mom worked on the racetrack as well. What was her role?
She was, I guess you'd say, groom. I mean, she took care of the horses. And she's anyone that knows our family, you know, my dad would never send one to the paddock that my mom didn't braid her mane and tail.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's going, I mean, way, way back. Yeah. And
wow.
My granddad did the same thing. So.
Wow. So your grandfather was a trainer as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So you had no choice. You were going to be in the business regardless, right? Was there ever any point when you decided or had a thought about doing anything else?
No. No, it's pretty much what I wanted to do. As I look back now, I probably wished I'd have done something different. But, you know, it's a lot different game than it used to be.
Yeah, what's changed?
It just, there's not really much loyalty anymore. You know, you see horses move from this barn to that barn, you know, whereas you didn't used to see that as much. Basically, if a guy had horse, you had horses for a guy, you'd have them for years and years. A lot of these guys anymore, they switch horses every, you know, time you turn around, it seems like. But just a lot of things. I don't know. It's just a different deal than it used to be.
If you could go back to the beginning and do things a little bit differently, what would you change, Randy?
Well, I wasn't brought up to be the PR type of trainer. And that's what you need to be this day and age to really, you know, to land your bigger clients and whatnot, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, I was taught when I brought up, you stayed at the barn and you worked and, you know, that type of role. Nowadays, they want you to put on a suit and tie and, you know, go tell them how great you are, I guess, or whatever. I don't know. It's just that part of it's changed a lot.
So I guess I'm not going to be following you on Twitter anytime soon, right?
No, not too much on that.
You know, I think so much of what we see now in this game is turning toward that. It's turning toward being out there on social media and all these. And that's just not in the sport of thoroughbred racing. We're seeing it, you know, in life in general and in all sports. And can you succeed in this sport without those types of things nowadays, the way the game is structured?
I mean, you know, like I said again, I'm very fortunate right now. I've got some really good people behind me. Randy Patterson that owns Moonshine Mullen, great owner. He's, you know, gave me a very good opportunity. And then I trained for Mr. Clark. He has put some really well-bred, nice young horses in my stable. And among others, you know, I'm really lucky right now. I've got some good clients backing me.
Well, it's interesting because you've kind of, you know, stayed true to your roots, and I'll call it old school, okay, because you've stayed true to those roots in the way you were brought up, but yet your stable continues to grow. Your numbers are increasing, aren't they?
Yeah, the last few years they have, yeah.
Is that just because of you basically treating people the way they want to be treated? Is that how you would sum it up?
I mean, that's the way I am, you know. I basically tell them if they send me a horse, if the horse can run, he can run. If he can't, you know, I'm be the first one to tell him, hey, you need to move this horse on. He's, you know, there's no sense of putting good money after bad.
Yeah. Now, it's important to have owners that understand that too, right?
Right. I mean, some of them every now and then, they don't want to hear that, you know. But, I mean, unfortunately, it is what it is. Some of them are good, some of them aren't.
Randy Morris here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, now, Randy, you've had success, and we're going to talk about some of your more notable horses. You've already mentioned More Luck and Prospector Song, but you seem to have success with all types of horses, from turf sprinters to distance races on the dirt. Why is that?
Like I say, it just goes back to the horse, you know. It isn't really so much what you do with them, this or that. It's having a fast horse. That's just all there is to it. I mean taking care of them and keeping them around, I think that's you know, the way you handle them and whatnot. But bottom line is you have to have an animal. It's like if you go getting a Jaguar and I get in a Volkswagen, you know, even if you don't know how to drive, you put Mario Andretti in the Volkswagen, you're still going to outrun him.
Sure. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the older horses, too, because we see you with a lot of older horses who continue to perform at a very high level later in their career, and that's a testament to your program and the way you bring horses along.
Yeah, well, that's the way I was taught. You know, if a horse has a problem, you back off of them and give them time. That's the way the old-timers done it. You know, it seems like a lot of these younger guys nowadays, they just kind of get what they can get and move on to the next one. Of course, you know, they might have 200 or 300 head of horses in training too. I guess you'd look at it maybe different if that was the case. But I like the horses too much to do that. If one's got a problem, I don't want to push them.
All right, so let's talk about some of those big name horses and some of the ones that have stuck around for a while. And you mentioned Morluck and how you claimed him, and then he goes on to be a millionaire. You also had another millionaire in your barn by the name of Jonesboro, who was a pretty darn good horse too. Tell me the story of Jonesboro.
Jonesboro, we actually bought him as a yearling at Keeneland, September. And he looked like he was going to be kind of on the Derby trail, and he actually, the last day of the meet at Oaklawn, he fractured a cannon bone. So we had to put screws in that, which in the long run, looking back at it now, was probably a blessing. That might be what kept him around so long. So he got a lot of time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of these horses nowadays, they don't let them develop. You know, they run them as two-year-olds when they're so early, and they just it hurts them, in my opinion.
So you think that maybe they should wait a little bit longer? Is that your...
I mean, every horse is different, but yeah. I mean, you can see a lot of these two-year-olds that went early, like now, and Saratoga even, for instance. Where are they at now? The ones that won this time last year.
Right.
You just don't see them around, you know?
Yeah, it seems like we see that every year. We see those young horses that are so precocious, and yet they don't follow through when they get into their three-year-old season, and if they even make it to their four-year-old season.
Yeah.
So if you get a young horse into your barn now, you get a really good two-year-old, are you tempted to wait before starting that horse?
Yeah, I don't like to run them even really till fall. I mean, every now and then you'll run one a little earlier. I've got one colt there that I'm going to run pretty soon, but he's kind of the little typier, speedier type of horse. But yeah, and that's Mr. Clark is... bought some really nice horses the last couple of years, and he's very patient, you know, lets me take my time with him. And we had a really good colt this year at Oaklawn and named Street Strategy, and he got hurt in the Rebel. Nothing major, but you know, he'll be off till this fall. So, but yeah, I think the longer, if you let them, you know, it just makes sense. Let them grow up and mature. They just become better.
Sure. Yeah, no, of course. And it seems to me, Randy, like you're always tweaking with the horses that you have in your care. And I'll give you an example. I read a quote about Moonshine Mullen after he won at Churchill Downs. What was it, Derby Day, I guess, right? It was the Ali Sheba.
Mm-hmm.
And you said afterwards that you made a change and decided to just let him roll on the front end, just let him do his thing and not try to wrangle him back and let him go. And that made all the difference in the world for him. Is that what you're doing? Are you always looking to kind of tweak and find that right formula for each individual horse?
Oh, sure. And that's where your jock can come into play a lot, you know, telling you things about them and whatnot. But yeah, absolutely. There's you know, a lot of times a horse, they just, if you don't take them back, they won't finish, and, you know, vice versa. I mean, he was, the two times we'd run him previous, Moonshine Mullen, he was just dragging the jock up the backside. And then when they get to the head of the lane, when he'd ask him to run, he just didn't have that big turn of foot, you know, to quicken.
Yep.
Whereas, and that's why I told him the third time we ran him there, just let him run, you know, because that's the way he's got that big high cruising speed, and I think that works in his advantage.
Do you have a go-to jockey that you rely on when the money's on the line and you need a good ride?
I mean, Calvin Burrell's won a lot of races for me, but there's a lot of good riders, you know. Not really. I mean, just, you know, whoever's, you naturally like to get whoever's kind of doing good. Because they're just like anybody else. They get in a slump. Things just don't work. But Calvin's won a lot of races for me. Calvin's not only a good jock, he's a horseman. He knows something about a horse.
Yep.
Whereas most of them don't.
Do trainers get in slumps too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When nothing goes right, it just nothing goes right. You know? you can lead what you think is five lengths the best horse over there, and something happens. It gets left at the gate, or, you know, there's a lot of ways to lose and only one way to win.
How do you persevere through those times? We hear with Major League Baseball hitters, when they get in a slump, they say, just keep swinging, just keep swinging. Eventually, things will come together. You'll start getting those hits. How do trainers deal with that when they're going through a rough patch?
You just have to, you know, Pat Day, a long time ago at Arlington Park, I ran a horse, and he was big, big favorite. And I was going through one of them spells. Nothing was going right. I mean, this horse was like 1-5. When they kicked it, he reared in the gate. So he lost all chance. And I remember walking back through the tunnel. We were talking. I said, it's just unbelievable. He says, look, everybody goes through these things. He says, one thing I can tell you, don't change nothing. You know what you're doing. Just keep doing what you're doing. It'll all turn around. And I've never forgot that, you know, so, and he's right. It comes and goes.
Well, it must be difficult to keep that faith in your, approach and your philosophy and in the way you're doing things when things aren't going right. Is that really hard to do?
Oh, absolutely. And what's really hard this day and age is, like I said earlier, is to keep your clients, you know, because that's the hardest part.
Well, I think everybody wants instant satisfaction, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So let's say you are in a bit of a slump and things aren't going right. Your owner comes to you. What are you telling them? How do you give them the advice that you need to give to them so that they stay calm and they stay with you and everything works out eventually?
Well, you know, you tell them, just be honest and tell them the truth. That's what I do. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, these things, they're horses. They're not machines. You know, we don't put a quarter in them and turn them on. So most people, though, that understand the game, you know, they understand that.
He's trainer Randy Morris. He's joining me on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Randy, I read somewhere, this was going back a couple of years, I read an article, I think it was in the Daily Racing Form, that was written about you and your operation at Oaklawn Park. And another staple of Oaklawn Park was the late Bob Holtis. And he died in November of 2011. But there was his barn there was a barn that you actually stabled your horses in after he passed away. And if I'm not mistaken, you had left all of his signage up and the red and white awnings and everything on his barn. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Bob was a good friend of mine, and Paul, his son, we've been friends for a lot of years. So yeah, I didn't feel it was appropriate to take it down at that point in time.
How long did you leave it up?
For that meet. And then that whole meet, actually.
Yeah, I had read somewhere, I guess you said that it just keeps his name out there, and that was really important to you?
Yeah, well, you know, everybody knew Bob. He was a good horseman and, you know, had a good career.
Which other trainers, I guess Bob probably the number one candidate based on what you're telling me, but who are some of the other trainers that you're closest to and that you tend to work most closely with when you're traveling around to the racetracks?
Oh, you know, we all know one another. It's, you know, I mean, not really. I talk to my dad probably more than anybody.
Really?
As far as the horses, this and that. Yeah. He's retired. He lives in Texas now, but I still talk to him, you know, 3-4 times a week. That's all we usually talk about is horses.
Will you ask him advice at this point, or do you just kind of just talk
absolutely.
To him?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, you never quit learning about these horses. You think you know it all about these horses, just stick around. They'll show you.
Yeah, well said. I guess it must mean a lot to your dad as well that you kind of keep him involved from that respect.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure he loves talking about them. I mean, you know, it's something when you've done it your whole life, you don't get it out of your blood, that's for sure.
And, of course, your dad, Charlie, training horses for so long at Oaklawn Park and in the Midwest. Did he ever think about going anywhere else?
He raced at Churchill a time or two back years ago. But, you know, he pretty much stayed out in there. A lot of it was due to, you know, the family, so where we'd go to school. And that's how they ended up in Sunland Park in El Paso. We could race there basically all winter. He'd get ready there and then go to Oaklawn from there.
Now, when you do get a big horse, like a Jonesboro, a Morlock, you won the big race with Testify at Churchill Downs as well. He was a nice turf sprinter. Is it more special, Randy, having your family so close to you and having them basically with you from day one? Is it more special being able to share that with your family when you have those big moments?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just wondering what that conversation's like at Christmas when you're all together. Is it all horses?
You know, yeah, usually it's a lot about a horse, but, you know. But on this racetrack, there's a lot of times we don't get to spend all days together either, you know. You're always going here or got to be somewhere.
And you said your sister is your main assistant. That's got to be special.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a good horseman. She's in at Prairie Meadows right now with the string horses out there.
Okay. Did she want to be a jockey as well when she was growing up?
No. No, I think really the only one of the kids was myself.
Were you pretty...
I had an older brother. He never really was interested in... He galloped horses, but he never, I don't think, he gave much thought to about being a jockey.
So were you pretty good? Could you ride?
Yeah, I can ride. I could ride, yeah.
Will you still get on your own horses now or no?
No, I don't gallop. I just ride the pony. I quit galloping. I got too big, you know. When you start feeling heavy on one, it's time to quit.
Yeah.
But I've been on plenty of them in my time.
So what you said, the game has changed so much. You mentioned you're more of an old school type of guy. What advice would you have for new people that come to you and say, hey, I would love to be a horse trainer. I love watching what you do. What advice do you give them?
Well, to be honest, you'd probably try to steer them another direction. Because it's a very tough game. And as we see, you know, we're starting to see more and more tracks close. You know, who knows what's going to happen with this game in the next years to come. But, I mean, if I had a son that wanted to train, I would send him to, he'd go to college, or would want him to go to college, you know, and learn a lot of different, like the school out there in Arizona, where Todd Fletcher went.
Yep. Yeah.
Something like that. And you know, and just like Todd, his dad, he was stabled by my father when I was growing up. I would have known him since I was a kid. And that's, you know, he sent Todd to, he went to school out there at Arizona State, is it? Or Arizona, I don't know.
Yeah, U of A.
And then he, you know, instead of coming to work for him, he put him with Wayne Lucas. So, you know, I think that really helped his career a lot. You know, he got to meet a lot of the bigger owners and whatnot.
He's Randy Morris. Randy, you stayed true to your roots, and it's been fun to hear your story, and want to wish you all the best moving forward with all your stable, and thanks so much for taking the time to be here on Trainer Talk. All of our guests who appear on the program are going to receive a gift from Flair Equine Nasal Strip, so we'll get those out to you, and really appreciate you taking a little time.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Randy.
Bye.
All right, Randy Morris here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Definitely old school. Bobby Barnett, he's kind of old school too. He's coming up next in the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Why sell at Phasic Tipton's summer selected horses of racing age sale?
Market trends.
Current market trends create huge premiums for horses with recent form.
Timing.
The July 14th sale date falls during transition time for stables and provides meaningful racing opportunities for new owners.
Flexibility.
The online catalog only until time of sale allows for entries to be taken up to 1 week prior to the sale date.
Innovation.
The online catalog features updated pedigrees and race records as they occur, along with Rogozin sheet numbers and race replays.
Graduate success.
2013 sales grads are off to a fast start, including Grade 3 winner Candyman E and stakes winners El Sano, Chow Bella Luna, Home Run Birdie, and Jaycito. Last year's inaugural sale was a tremendous success with an average of $105,000, a median of $45,000, with a low RNA rate of just 15%. The Phasic Tipton Summer Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale, Monday, July 14th in Lexington, Kentucky. Visit phasictipton.com for more information.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
Have you dreamed of owning a racehorse, or have you already experienced the thrill of visiting the Winner's Circle? Either way, the inaugural Thoroughbred Owner Conference at Keeneland has something for you. Expert panel discussions, presentations from thoroughbred trainers and owners, a day at the races, social events, and even a keynote address from Hall of Fame golfer and thoroughbred owner Gary Player. Mark your calendar for the Thoroughbred Owner Conference in Lexington, Kentucky, October 13 through 16, and visit ownerview.com today to register. That's ownerview.com.
Nipissing's coming on, and it's Nipissing in the center. Outside, spring in the air. Nipissing, absolutely flawless to win the Woodbine Oaks.
The countdown to the Queen's Plate continues with the Woodbine Oaks presented by Budweiser on Sunday, June 15th. Post time is 1 p.m. The card features the $500,000 Woodbine Oaks and the Queen's Plate trial, plus a guaranteed early and late pick four of $100,000. Visit WoodbineRacetrack.com for details.
Interested in handicapping tournaments? Daily Racing Form has you covered. First, visit drf.com/tournaments to get information on upcoming online qualifiers for the DRF NTRA National Handicapping Championship, the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, Public Handicapper, and handicapping contests at DRF Bets. See contest schedules, prize details, links to tournament blogs, and more. Everything you need to enter and play. You'll find it all at drf.com/tournaments. Then check out The Winning Contest Player by Peter Thomas Fornatal, the newest title from DRF Press. In this 320-page book, Fornatal interviews over 30 of the country's best players and, with their assistance, lays out a complete strategy to help you win. Order it today at drf.com. And don't forget to visit drf.com/tournaments to get all the details on upcoming qualifiers, contests, and more. That's drf.com/tournaments.
HRRN takes you inside the world of thoroughbred racing with a variety of programs.
Take me through a list of programs.
Don't miss the Equine Forum every Saturday morning.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah, I like that.
Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, Wednesday evenings.
Storytelling is big for me.
The Brisnet.com call-in show on Thursdays.
Having people talk to the radio by telephone is an exciting idea.
And the ExpressBet Weekend Stakes preview show every Friday.
On the money, check it.
Plus, hear live racing from across the country every Wednesday through Friday on HRRN Live. And HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events. with exclusive coverage of the Triple Crown, Breeders' Cup World Championships, and more.
Wow, that's huge.
Make HRRN your home for all things thoroughbred racing on the radio.
What time is it?
Go to horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule of all our programming or to listen live online.
This is Al Stahl, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. And a fun visit in the first half of the program with Randy Morse. Looking forward to the second half as well, as trainer Bobby Barnett is with me. 1,361 career winners to his credit. Those runners have earned $37 million in purse earnings. A little bit more than that, actually. He is a 64-year-old native of Texas, and as the saying goes, he's forgotten more about training horses than many will ever know. Bobby, thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
All right, thank you for having me and calling me, you bet.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to have you on board and to hear your story. Now, you grew up actually in Northeast Louisiana, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Northeast Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, okay.
Yeah.
Take me back to that, because you were involved with racing at a very young age.
Yeah, I was born in the Texas Panhandle, and then my mother and dad and sister, we moved to Northeast Oklahoma just very shortly after that. So I guess I'm a full-fledged Okie instead of a Texan.
So, come on, it's all about the Sooners for you?
Yeah. Not now. Both our daughters graduated from LSU, so now it's the LSU Tigers.
It better be. You'll be in trouble.
Yeah.
So what was your first experience with being around horses and being around the sport of racing?
You know, we there in Northeast Oklahoma, it's called green country. It's cow country. My dad had cattle and horses, and my mother, and then he had a rodeo and racehorse background. And I don't know, we started matching races about when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I got to riding a few of them. I was very light back then, and that's how it was, just out in the cow pasture with a set of gates, and some of them were even lap tap. That's where you just ride up to the line and guy drops his hat and you're off. You take off. So you try to cheat getting up there.
Wow. Now, did you have interest? A lot of trainers have told me they have interest in being a jockey before they became a trainer. Was that your initial thought?
Yes, it sure was. It sure was. My dad didn't. He was a rodeo cowboy, and he didn't want me to ride Bronx. He said I could make a little more money and stay sounder probably riding racehorses. So that's why I tended that away. And I rode them for about 7 years, and then I got too heavy. So anyway, then I started training. The training part of it's a lot harder than the jockey part.
Well, I'm sure it is. What attracted you to racing?
My mom and my dad, you know, they had horses, and we on the weekends we would run match races when we were out of school, and in the springs, you know, we'd go around to Texas and Oklahoma, and then they had didn't have pari-mutuel tracks in Oklahoma, but they had quarter horse, you know, approved tracks approved by the Quarter Horse Association, but where I got started was riding the match races there in Northeast Oklahoma.
Were you pretty good?
Well, the first race I rode, I won, and it was up and down. Like I say, that's all I did for 7 years, so I guess I was good enough to eat on. But you know, you as a jockey, you can't eat too much, so it sort of served its own purpose. It was okay. We spent a couple of summers in New Mexico, and then we ran a lot around Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas and Missouri up in there some too. Yeah, with the quarter horses.
So how old were you when you finally decided, hey, this riding thing's not going to work out, I want to train horses?
I think it was around 18, 19, somewhere there.
And how did you get started? What was the first job or the
started
first person?
Training, yeah.
Yeah.
We went to New Mexico with a gentleman from Northeast Oklahoma there, had very good quarter horses. Ronnie Sleep was his name. Went to Ruidoso with him, and then went back and went after that, went back helping my dad, you know, train some horses. And he was in Colorado at the time. And then I went to Delta Downs the first year that they opened with some quarter horses and, you know, didn't make much of an impact down there. But then went back to Northeast Oklahoma, and then I took a job on a farm, and I was back there a short while. And at the sale, I got reacquainted with Wayne Lucas. You know, I knew Wayne from the quarter horse days. You know, knew him a little bit, and I told him, you know, I knew he was in California, and I said, if something comes up, give me a call. And he said, I got a job for you right now if you want to go. I said, all right. So I moved my family out there in 80, and we were out there, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and then came back to Oklahoma City, and I was there on a farm, Celestial Acres, for a little while. And then I went to Louisiana Downs and started training. Just real lucky to pick up some horses for John Franks. And we had a good run there before Mr. Franks passed away. So,
now, when you went to California with Wayne, you said that he said, hey, I have a job for you right now. And you packed up, you moved the whole family out there. Was that a difficult decision, or was your wife, everybody in favor of it?
They were in favor. You know, the daughters were real young. Neither one of them were in school yet. And that's, you know, what we wanted was the racing part of it. So it was a great opportunity. A great opportunity.
What was it like for a kid from Oklahoma going out to California?
Well, it was probably a week or 10 days before I had enough nerve to get on the freeway.
I'm sure.
But it was quite an experience. About the first day I was there, Wayne and I were sitting out on the racetrack on pony horses, and I was looking at the San Gabriel Mountains, and he rode by me, and he said, shut your mouth up there, Okie. You know, I was just really, it was just amazing how I see why everybody moved to California now.
Yeah. Well,
Beautiful.
What's the one thing you took away from working with Wayne?
You know, he showed me a way of taking very, very good care of horses. And I'll never, you know, never forget that. He still showed me a great way to care for them. And I was around some good horse flesh too. That was unbelievable. You know, we were sitting there one day, and one went by he'd just broken his maiden, I think, for $32,000 the day before, and you know, $3,200 was a big horse for me. So, you know, it was quite an experience to be with Wayne.
Bobby Barnett, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bobby, you are one of several trainers to come from that D. Wayne Lucas tree that have been ultra successful in the sport. Why have so many Wayne Lucas assistants, been so successful?
Well, you know, he Wayne can do it, and if you catch up, you know, get off a little bit of what he's doing, and you know, it doesn't hurt any at all. So, and when I went to Louisiana, I was fortunate enough to get some horses for Mr. Franks and Frankie Brothers and Dr. McClure and Dr. Reed. They helped. They aided in that. So it was a great break. Sure,
yeah.
Was.
Was it a difficult decision to make?
No. You mean the moves from California to... First, when we left, I left Wayne, I moved back to on a place in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
And was there a couple of years, and then I went to Louisiana Downs. And then raced at New Orleans at the fairgrounds, and then back to Louisiana Downs. And that's when I picked up some horses for Mr. Franks, and then... it built up from year to year, and we had a very, very 16, 17 year run at it. So Mr. Franks, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to train for him.
Yeah, very much so. And of course,
yeah.
Mr. Franks passing away in 2003, and he was really a staple of the sport for so many years. And as you mentioned, you were a big part of that success. Talk about that relationship and how it came about and what he meant to your operation and your career.
You know, I first started to run the horse on the grass there at Louisiana Downs. His name was Vaguely Crafty, and Colt, we had bought it, I think, the Fassick Tipton in Houston. And he was a pretty fair grass horse, and Mr. Franks had a grass horse, and we would converse some in the paddock, you know, and he'd say, "It's my turn to win," and I'd say, "No, it's my turn to win." And so that's how we sort of got acquainted. And then the next year, he made a call and asked if I'd be interested in training some horses, and I said, sure. And remember the first horse I started for him, I think he sent me four horses in. The very first one I started ran last. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Because he's a tough man, in which he was. But he was honest and never tried to beat you out of anything. And I gave him my excuse, what I thought happened to the horse. And he said, well, okay, it'll be better from here. And sure enough, it was. So maybe that was a blessing, that first horse ran last.
Well, and I'm sure he was somebody that, after being in the game for so long, really mm-hmm. understood the ups and downs, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure that makes it a lot easier to work with somebody like that. Of course, the big horse that you had, there were several, but probably the biggest name might be Answer Lively, who was, of course, the Eclipse Award winner, the Eclipse Award two-year-old of 1998. He won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile that year at Churchill Downs. Tell me about that experience going down that road with John Franks and being part of the Breeders' Cup.
You know, that sure was. That was a homebred colt that he raised himself. And Phil Ronick was at the farm there with him in Ocala, and he called me in January, and he said, we've got a good colt here. He looks like he's really, really going to be a nice one. So I want to get him to you early. So anyway, we got him and got him at Keeneland. And I think his first race, he was fourth. And then he came back and won. And then, let's see, we ran him. We were headquartered at Louisiana Downs, and we had some horses coming back for Churchill and put him on the van. We thought we'd be able to run him, you know, up here, but two-year-olds, other than if you don't run the stake, it's hard to run them. So we finally wound up running him at Ellis, and he flipped in the gates that day. And in fact, Calvin Burrell was riding him, and neither one of them were hurt. So anyway, then we took him back, by that time, I think we ran him once at Lone Star, and he showed blistering speed, broke from the outside and just never could get over and ran bad. And then we took him back to Louisiana Downs, and he won allowance race and then won the sport, the two-year-old race there. And then we went on to Keeneland and really knew we had a nice colt. And he was second there in the Breeders' Futurity. I believe Cat Thief, Wayne had Cat Thief, and he beat us about a half a side. And then we went on to the Breeders' Cup, which was at Churchill, and we went into the race as a favorite. And I think one reason was we got picked up Jerry Bailey to ride, and sure enough, we pulled it off, and he won and was voted champion two-year-old that year. He came back as a three-year-old and had a lot of throat problems, and ran some decent races. Second in the Louisiana Derby, second in the Remington Derby, but he never did come back like his two-year-old year.
When you won the Breeders' Cup for John Franks, did you look at him and tell him, hey, you were right, you said it would get better after that first starter, and it certainly has?
Yeah, I think over the years, I mentioned that to him a time or two, and he said, sure enough, it was. He sometimes was Mr. Franks was sometimes a little hard to read, but if you get in that stream and you follow him, it worked pretty well. He, like I say, he was a fine gentleman. He sure was.
Well,
the industry misses him, and I tell you what, I really miss him.
You were ready. You actually made it back to Churchill the following spring with Answer Lively for the Kentucky Derby. It to date is your only Derby starter. What was that like?
That was quite an experience. You know, anybody in the trains racehorses, that, you know, that's the number one race is the Kentucky Derby, you know, and I think we weren't beat too bad that day. I think about 8-10 lengths. And I remember, Craig Perrett rode our colt. And I remember Pat Dave's comment after the race. He said that's the roughest Kentucky Derby he'd ever ridden in. There was a lot of banging and going on. I don't think there were any inquiries, but it was a lot of bumping and grinding going on in the race.
Well, when you get to that point, Bobby, where you're winning Breeders' Cup Juveniles, you're competing in the Kentucky Derby, how bad does that make you want to get back there again?
You bet. It's out there. They have it yearly, but things have slowed down considerably for me. And I'm out here every day, and we train here at Kentucky in the summers, and then go to New Orleans in the winter. So it's out there. The opportunity's there, but sometimes we need a little help, and hopefully things will get it going back strong again.
Outside of John Franks, who were some of the other people that really helped you along the way?
I had some people there that, well, we won the Super Derby for them one year with Fantastic Cat. They had bought one of Mr. Franks's place in Opelousas, and I had, over the years had horses for them, and I think that was in 2004 we won that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, but we've had a lot of success in Louisiana. It's been very good to us.
Well, you were based year round in Louisiana and Arkansas until what, the late 1990s or so?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. I think our last year at Louisiana down was 99, and then we'd pull out of New Orleans early and go to Hot Springs, and had several years there, real good meets at Hot Springs. That's a great place to race. And man, that racing there has really gotten good now. Mr. Pope, my hat's off to him. He's done a great job there.
Well, I can remember back in, what was it, 97, you had that streak of six straight starters that you won with over 2 days at Oaklawn, and then it included that victory by Halo America and the Apple Blossom.
Yeah, six consecutive wins. And it's funny, I had a horse for a lady, Gloria Sykes from Missouri, and she had her filly in. She called me and she said, "I want you to scratch my horse." I said, "Why?" She said, "I don't want to break your luck." And I said, "No, it'll probably break before that. But I appreciate you. I appreciate the call." So yeah, that was quite a run there. Sure was. That was exciting. You'd win one, you just sort of look around and say, "What happened?" And yeah, that was a good run. It's been very, very, very good to us, horse racing now.
When you're in the middle of a streak like that, Bobby, and we all know that this game has the highest highs and the lowest lows, and it can change in a heartbeat, but when you're in the middle of a streak like that, is it something where you're doing everything exactly the same as you did for the last starter? Do you get that kind of superstition like a lot of athletes would?
Yeah, it's something that at times it just all falls into place. And one year at New Orleans on Champions Day, we won four stakes there and a couple in Texas. It was just fell into place. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you're beating a nose and a head and that, and that's what throws it off. But it just all falls into place. A lot of luck in this game.
Now, when you finally decided to kind of move the base of your operations to Kentucky, again, probably late 90s, I guess, right?
Uh-huh, yes.
That decision, why that decision at that time in your career?
The Franks operation, Mr. Franks was in very bad, getting in bad health. And things were slowing down really, really fast with Mr. Franks and him in Louisiana there. His health was getting bad. So anyway, that was one of the, that was probably the decision right there.
Bobby Barnett, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bobby, when you think back on your career and some of the horses you've been around, some of the people you've been around, what are you most proud of?
The business has been very good to us. It's a very unforgiving business, but I have a great family. We have two daughters that my wife Debbie and I have two daughters that graduated LSU, and I'm mostly proud of them. And like I say, I couldn't have done it without John Franks and all his good horses. But when I look back, and Mario Convento, he's worked for me 26 years, I guess, in the system. He does anything, and having good help, and it's a great business. It sure is.
Now, do your daughters have any interest in being involved in racing?
No, they are. They both have lives of their own. Grandchildren, have three grandchildren, and they didn't take up anything. They still keep up with it, come and go to the races with us when they're in town, but they swayed away from it.
So they weren't hanging out around the barn as little kids and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, they were. Oh, yeah, were they? They used to get up with me and go to the barn early, and as they got older, they got their own lives, and that's quickly changed. They did chores around the barn, painted, and remember how hot it was in Bossier City, Louisiana, Louisiana Downs. Those summers there, it's like no other place in the United States.
And your wife, Debbie, did you meet her on the racetrack?
No, she worked at a bank in Orange, Texas. It was close to Delta Downs there, so that's how we met.
Oh, she was taking care of all the money you were making at that point.
Yeah, all of it. Yeah, covering my hot checks. Yeah.
I started by saying that you've probably forgotten more about training than many trainers will ever know. What is your overall philosophy to training horses, Bobby?
You have to start with, you've got to have a great foundation. You've got to have the horses, and you've got to have people behind you that believe in you. I'm very lucky. I picked up a couple of new owners from Lexington there, the Greens, Bob and Marilyn Green, and they I've been trained for them about a year, but they're fine. You got to have people that will believe in you and let you do something with them. Not just put them in the race. Just to watch them run. You've got to have somebody behind you that also believes in you, that'll give you the time and let you do what the horse needs to be done.
So outside of Answer Lively and Halo America, we've talked about those two, or at least mentioned them. You mentioned JJ's Dream, Fantastic Cat. Tell me about another horse that you're never going to forget.
An old horse named Precocity. Mr. Franks bought him off Bob Baffert, and we beat Real Quiet with him his first race back after the classics at New Orleans, and Real Quiet was second in the handicap. And Bob after the race, he said, "Yeah, my horse needs to race." And so we went up the road to Lone Star and beat him with another horse. We beat him again up there in the Texas Mile. He won that race 2 years in a row. But probably old Precocity. That was an old hard-knocking horse. He won a lot of good races.
All right, so only a couple of minutes left here, Bobby. I always like to end Trainer Talk by asking our trainers what they like to do when they're away from the racetrack. And I know you don't get a lot of time, but when you're away from the racetrack, what other hobbies and interests or things do you like to do?
I have no other hobbies, no other interests. The last time I went fishing was 1984. The last time I played golf was 1968. So there isn't a lot of that. I really enjoy the grandchildren and the racing part of it. It's my life.
He's trainer Bobby Barnett, and that is his life. And Bobby, can't thank you enough for spending a little time on Trainer Talk here tonight. Been a delight to hear your story. We could have gone for another half hour easy, but really appreciate it. And all of our guests who appear on the program receive a gift courtesy of our sponsor, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So I'll send those out to you. And thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank Mike. Thank you and your crew there so much. I really did appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Bobby.
Made me feel comfortable. Made me feel good. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Bobby.
Okay, bye.
Bobby Barnett here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. You're not going to find a nicer gentleman than Bobby Barnett. Randy Morse, outstanding in the first half of the program as well. You can go back and listen to a podcast on our website, horseracingradio.net, if you missed any of it. And you can check out all of the podcasts of every single Trainer Talk. They're all there on our homepage, horseracingradio.net. My thanks to, of course, Phasic Tipton for the title sponsorship of this program. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna, and we will talk to you next time here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Thanks for listening.